Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the May 26th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is This Is Your Priest on Drugs by Michael Pollan. Department of Psychopharmacology, This Is Your Priest on Drugs. Dozens of religious leaders experienced magic mushrooms in a university study. Many are now evangelists for psychedelics, by Michael Pollan. In October 2015, Hunt Priest, then a minister at Emmanuel Episcopal Church on Mercer Island in Washington State, was flipping through the Christian Century, a progressive Protestant magazine, when an advertisement caught his eye, seeking clergy to take part in a research study of psilocybin and sacred experience. Psilocybin is a hallucinogenic compound found in certain mushrooms. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University and NYU wanted to administer it to religious leaders who had an interest in further exploring and developing their spiritual lives. Priest, a slight, bearded, and disarmingly open man from a small town, Kentucky, grew up in a Protestant church-going family and felt a religious calling as a teenager. He went to work for Delta Airlines, but he told me that, in his 30s, I began to feel something was missing in my spiritual life. He started reading Buddhist texts, including Thich Nhat Hanh's Living Buddha, Living Christ, which eventually steered him back toward Christianity. At 37, he entered seminary. By the time Priest saw the ad, he was burned out. He ministered to an affluent bedroom community near Seattle, and felt that his work had become more about institutional administration and maintenance. That will wrench the spirituality out of most people. He had never experienced psychedelics, a requirement for participation in the study, and had heard some horror stories. Still, he had always been curious. The study was at a respected university and legal. Why the hell would I not do this? He thought. He began the arduous process of qualifying to participate. A series of phone calls, long questionnaires, in-person interviews in Baltimore, and a medical exam. The team behind the ad included Roland Griffiths and William Richards, Hopkins scholars who had contributed to the so-called Renaissance of psychedelic research, which began around the turn of the millennium. Griffiths, a psychopharmacologist, first became interested in psychedelics after he had a mystical experience while meditating. That day he encountered something way, way beyond a material worldview that I can't really talk to my colleagues about because it involves metaphors or assumptions that I'm really uncomfortable with as a scientist, he told me in 2014. His most influential research focused on therapeutic applications of psychedelics. In a 2016 paper published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, Griffiths, Richards, and several other scientists reported that psilocybin could help treat fear and anxiety in cancer patients. The study has been cited more than 1,000 times. Numerous clinical trials of psilocybin, MDMA, and other psychedelics followed. I first encountered the small community of psychedelic researchers while writing about the cancer study for this magazine. I met many more when I wrote a book about their work, and since then I've argued that psychedelics have the potential to treat mental illness and teach us about the mind. In 2020, I helped establish a psychedelic research center at UC Berkeley, and after I learned that Griffiths was dying of cancer, I donated to a new chaired professorship that he considered a part of his legacy. Along the way, I learned that in 2012, Richards and Anthony Bosis, a clinical psychologist at NYU, had started discussing psychedelics and religion. To me, these experiences can be spiritual, Bosis told me, when we met at his Manhattan office. The researchers set out to answer several questions. Would psychedelic experiences enhance the well-being and vocation of religious leaders as compared with study participants in a control group who were still waiting for a session? Would the experience renew their faith or make them question it? The group secured financial support from several major funders, in the psychedelic world, including T. Cody Swift, a philanthropist who has a master's degree in existential phenomenological psychology, and Carrie and Claudia Turnbull, who have funded studies and invested in companies that are pursuing psychedelic medical treatments. Swift and Claudia Turnbull both went on to participate in the research, Swift by interviewing participants and writing a narrative account of their sessions, and Turnbull by facilitating sessions at Johns Hopkins. Priest was ultimately accepted into the study alongside about 30 other religious leaders, including a Catholic priest, a Baptist biblical scholar, several rabbis, an Islamic leader, and a Zen Buddhist Roshi. The joke about walking into a bar almost writes itself. Priest was one of four Episcopalians. The final sample, like the demographics of the study team, skewed white, 97%, Christian, 76%, and male, 69%. Recruitment through ads and direct outreach to religious communities proved difficult, especially from religions such as Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism. Religious prescriptions against mind-altering substances may have played a role. Finding willing rabbis, however, was easy. The challenge was finding ones who were psychedelically naive. Scientifically speaking, the study had serious limitations, many of them acknowledged by its authors. The sample was small, self-selecting, and unrepresentative. Several faiths were not included, and there was no placebo control. Expectancy effects can also have a profound impact on psychedelic research, and a case can be made that participants were primed to have a certain kind of experience. On questionnaires filled out months after their sessions, for example, participants were asked about their sacred experience. Andrew Gelman, a statistician at Columbia who is an expert on study design, read a draft of the paper that resulted from the study and told me in an email, "I guess the punchline is that if you enroll people in a study and tell them they're going to have a sacred experience, then some people will have a sacred experience." Zach Kamenetz, a Berkeley-based rabbi who participated in the study, also told me that the language used by some researchers, as well as the music played during sessions, the playlist included Anya, a Christmas choral work Om Nayam Shivana, and lots of Bach, betrayed a distinctly Christian slant. As an odd sort of ethnography, though, the study tells a provocative story. It's not often that a group of clergy members recount a high-dose psilocybin trip. Would people steeped in theology and religious practice offer uniquely informed or nuanced accounts of mystical experiences? Would they encounter imagery or symbolism from their faith? Or might their experiences point to something more universal, a common core shared by all religions? Among participants who had two sessions, the researchers found that a striking number, 79%, reported that the experience had enriched their prayer, their effectiveness in their vocation, and their sense of the sacred in daily life. 96% rated their first encounters with psilocybin as being among the top five most spiritually significant experiences of their lives. Perhaps the most intriguing question went unmentioned in the scientific paper, although it came to mind for many study participants. At a time when organized religion has become struggling with declining membership, especially among the young, could carefully prepared and guided psychedelic experiences, whether for clergy or for the members of their congregations, have the potential to spark a revival of interest in religion? This is a controversial idea, so I was surprised to hear Priest and several other participants say that they believe they could. Most of the researchers were more circumspect, but Richards, an infectiously cheerful clinical psychologist who is now in his 80s, was happy to entertain the possibility. Before Richards completed a PhD in counseling, he earned master's degrees in divinity and theology. Psychedelics can give new life to the dogma by helping people understand where the dogma came from, he told me at his home in West Baltimore. One way to look at psychedelics is as a revelation happening in the present. Then perhaps mindful of the potential for religious or scientific backlash, he added, let's not frighten the horses. Richard's convictions and his aspirations for psychedelics prompt questions about the objectivity of such research. Rick Strassman, a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico, who conducted psychedelic research in the early 90s, suggested to me that at least some of the researchers came to the study with a mission to demonstrate the spiritual and psychological value of psilocybin. He pointed to the risk of selection bias. Those who volunteer are likely to be spiritually hungering for a mystical experience, which increases the chances that they will have one. I would not think that a stodgy Talmudic scholar would want to participate, he told me. For them, it's the word and the law. Spiritual experience alone is not that important. In 2020, Matthew Johnson, a Johns Hopkins researcher and a co-author of the Religious Leaders Study, made similar warnings in an article titled Consciousness, Religion, and Gurus, Pitfalls of Psychedelic Medicine. He wrote of scientists and clinicians imposing their personal religious or spiritual beliefs on the practice of psychedelic medicine. When Priest stepped into the psychedelic session room at Johns Hopkins, he felt both excited and anxious. The vibe of the space was more living room than clinic. It had a cozy couch for participants to lie on, vaguely spiritual-looking artwork on the walls, and a small statue of the Buddha on a bookshelf. Richard, who has a wide, toothy grin, was one of the two facilitators, or guides, present to supervise the experience. Priest told me that before he took the blue capsule that Richards offered him in an incense burner shaped like a chalice, he admitted to feeling nervous. He couldn't recall exactly what Richard said in response, but he remembered the message that he received. You should be nervous. You're about to meet God. The cross-pollination of religion and psychedelics has a long history. In the psychedelic community, it is virtually an article of faith that hallucinogenic plants and fungi played a role in the visions and mystical experiences that help give rise to some religions. The Eleusinian Mysteries, the annual rite honoring Demeter that was performed in Greece for nearly 2,000 years, climaxed with the consumption of a potion called the Kaikion, which was said to give participants visions of the afterlife and enable them to commune with their ancestors. Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist who discovered LSD in 1938, suspected that the recipe included ergot, the fungus on which his discovery was based. Demeter is the goddess of agriculture and fertility. Ergot grows on grain. In the New World, peyote, psilocybin and mushrooms, and the seeds of the Oliqui, a type of morning glory, have had sacramental use for all millennia. In the early aughts, scientists dated two specimens of peyote found in a cave near the Rio Grande at more than 5,000 years old. After Spanish colonizers arrived, the Catholic Church banned the use of mushrooms in Aztec rituals. The Nahuatl word for them, Tionatcatl, translates roughly as flesh of the gods, which must have sounded like a direct challenge to the Christian sacrament. The practice continued underground, however, and similar customs persist today. The U.S. banned peyote in the late 19th century, but the Native American Church, which fuses indigenous and Christian beliefs, fought a prolonged legal and legislative battle for the right to use the peyote cactus in its ceremonies. The effort ended successfully in 1993, when Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Since then, two churches that originated in Brazil have secured the right to use ayahuasca during ceremonies in the U.S. Psychedelic churches, some sincere in their spiritual convictions and others not so much, are opening at an accelerated rate. Lawyers in the newly formed Psychedelic Bar Association say that this trend has been encouraged by the Supreme Court's expansive approach to religious liberty. In 1962, Walter Pahnke, a Harvard graduate student who studied under the psychologist and psychedelic advocate Timothy Leary, administered either a pill containing psilocybin or a placebo to 20 volunteers, mostly Protestant divinity students. The volunteers then sat in the basement of Marsh Chapel at Boston University and listened to a Good Friday sermon piped in from the pulpit above them. Of the 10 volunteers who received the drug, 8 reported powerful mystical experiences. In the placebo group, 1 did. The researchers' definition of mysticism mirrored the one in the Varieties of Religious Experience in a 1902 collection of lectures by the psychologist and philosopher William James, who experimented with nitrous oxide. James associated mystical experiences with a sense of well-being, timelessness, ineffability, and unity with ultimate reality. Pankey's published research failed to mention that, as participants recalled years later, one person fled the chapel and headed toward Commonwealth Avenue, possibly to spread the word of Jesus to passersby. He had to be restrained and given an injection of the antipsychotic Thorazine. Another participant, Houston Smith, was a leading scholar of religion. Until the Good Friday experiment, he told an interviewer in 1996, I had had no direct personal encounter with him, her, it. Griffiths, Richards, and their colleagues were inspired in part by the Good Friday experiment. In a study published in 2006, they administered psilocybin to several dozen volunteers, who then filled out surveys that included a mystical experience questionnaire. The questionnaire drew on Pankey's experiment and James's writings. The researchers ultimately concluded that psilocybin could reliably occasion mystical experiences. Priest's psychedelic journey at Johns Hopkins followed norms that have become common in modern psychedelic research. After several preparatory sessions with 2 guides, the participant swallows the capsule, lies down on a couch, and dons a pair of headphones and an eye mask to encourage an inward focus. The facilitators say little but share words of advice or comfort if the experience turns frightening, and in and through is a common refrain. Although touch is considered a boundary violation in conventional psychotherapy, psychedelic therapists sometimes offer a hand to hold or a pat on the shoulder. Consent for touch is discussed in advance and reiterated in the moment. Participants and facilitators also rehearse touch beforehand. After the Hopkins and NYU sessions, participants filled out multiple questionnaires and wrote a narrative of their experience. The next day, they returned for an integration session to help make sense of what can be a confusing experience. They could also participate in a follow-up psilocybin session. Of the 29 participants who completed a first session, 5 did not return for a second. Like virtually all the religious leaders I spoke with, Priest reported an encounter with the divine. His session began with gorgeous visuals, fractal patterns that reminded him of mosaics in a mosque. Then a spiraling current of electricity seemed to take up residence in his left thigh. He felt it move powerfully up his body and lodge in his throat. I thought my Adam's apple was about to explode, he told me. Both guides could sense his distress, and one reached out to comfort him. Priest later spoke publicly about a guide touching his head, which drew criticism online, but a university review of video recordings contradicted Priest's account. To Priest, the touch felt like the ritual Christian gesture of laying on of hands. He remembers a guide holding his feet as the electrical sensation intensified. It blew out of the top of my head, and then I started making these sounds that felt religious and spiritual and sacred, Priest recalled. I realized I was speaking in tongues, which I had never done before. Speaking in tongues is not an Episcopal sort of thing. Looking back, Priest described the experience in distinctly religious, but not in strictly Christian terms. I would say now that my throat chakra had been blocked for a long time, he said. I just felt blocked in what I was preaching. Priest described the quality of his encounter with the divine as erotic. So did a couple of other participants. One talked about having a spiritual orgasm. Priest also spoke of a reversal of gender roles. The divine felt more masculine, and I felt like I was experiencing it the way a woman would, he told me. It felt so foreign to me as a man that I felt this must be how a woman experiences sexuality. After the session, a friend came to pick up Priest and was surprised to find his face flush. I looked completely different, Priest said. I was like a new creation. Not everyone in the study left their session with such a theological clarity. A Catholic priest from Mexico told me about hearing directly from Jesus, but a Protestant minister said, with a shrug, that there was nothing particularly Christian about it. The Buddhist Roshi told me that her experience was not life-altering, but led her into a completely non-conceptual realm, which she could find no words to describe. Rita Powell, now the Episcopal chaplain at Harvard, declined a second session because her first at NYU brought her face-to-face with the abyss. Speaking about her experience on a Harvard panel about psychedelics and religion, Powell said that her facilitators had not prepared her for something so dark. One of them kept trying to reassure me that our experience of psilocybin were good and beautiful and unitive, she said. It seemed like kind of a sloppy hippie stuff about love and harmony. She said that at one point in her session, she was nowhere. There was neither color nor its absence. There was no form or its absence. There was not fear. There was not joy. There was not revelation. There was nothing. She described it as maybe the hardest thing I had done in my life, something that took her to the furthest limit of human capacity. A peer-reviewed academic paper, Effects of Psilocybin on Religious and Spiritual Attitudes and Behaviors in Clergy from Various Major World Religions, appears in Psychedelic Medicine this month. Its senior authors are Bosis and Steve Ross, a psychiatry professor at NYU. Swift, the funder who helped debrief some of the participants, also sent me a narrative account that highlights some themes from 16 interviews. It reads almost like a psychedelic oral history. Interviewees tended to report authentic spiritual or religious experiences, the account notes. A priest is quoted as saying, "I wasn't dreaming, I wasn't imagining, I wasn't hallucinating." Many participants liken their experience to those of historical and scriptural figures. I was able to experience what the mystics were, for some reason, able to experience spontaneously, a pastor said. I don't think that my experience was less than theirs. According to the interviews, the divine was not usually embodied or visible, but rather felt as a presence that suffused reality or as a sense of oneness. I realized my very pulse is God, my very breath is God, a rabbi said. Several participants were surprised to encounter imagery or dogma outside their own faith. A Congregationalist minister described turning into an Aztec god and then the Hindu god Shiva. No one I spoke to, not even the rabbis, described seeing the stereotypical god of the Old Testament. And many of the religious leaders, men and women alike, experienced the divine as a feminine presence. Participants characterized God as soothing, maternal, or womb-like. A United Methodist pastor from Alabama called this mind-blowing. Jamie Clark Soles, the Baptist biblical scholar in the study, told me, "God struck me as a Jewish mother at one point, which is funny since I'm a Jesus follower." One of Priest's fellow Episcopalians, a man, reported, "I had a total deconstruction of patriarchal religion." It was common for participants to gain an appreciation for religions other than their own. All the truths are in all the religions, one rabbi said. The active ingredients are all the same. A Congregationalist who previously had little patience for charismatic expressions of Christianity, the hands in the air, the talking, speaking in tongues, and all the weirdness, observed after a session that pathways toward the truth are even more varied than I thought. Some felt a marked tension between the conventions of their faith and the immediacy of their psilocybin experience. I think I have less tolerance for institutional religion now, a Presbyterian minister is quoted as saying. There are other ways to connect with the divine. Here was the entire history of world religions in a nutshell. Orthodoxy and authority in tension with the direct spiritual experience of the individual. Sugar Ahmed, the only Muslim in the religious leaders study, told me that she was petrified before her first session. Like many others, she was apprehensive about what she would learn about herself. She also feared that her participation would be considered taboo in her community of British Muslims. Would they think I was bringing shame on us as a people, she told me. She asked the researchers to obscure her identity in their papers, and for years she spoke to no one about her experience. But more recently, she concluded that, for the sake of her personal authenticity, she needed to go on the record. Ahmed, who is in her 40s, has a round, open face and speaks in complete paragraphs. She grew up in the north of England, the daughter of immigrant Pakistanis. She went to the mosque after school every day. Her parents prayed at home and fasted for Ramadan. She studied English language and literature at university and was working in IT when 9/11 happened. Determined to better understand both the roots of Islam and the sudden surge of prejudice, she remembered people treating her as a security threat when she was boarding a bus. She earned a graduate degree in Islamic studies. For a time, she wore the hijab. She was the first woman to chair the Islamic Society of Britain and then became an associate dean for religious life at Stanford, leading prayers and preaching ecumenically at a church on campus. Ahmed describes herself using a feminine honorific given to religious scholars or teachers, Ustada. She volunteered for the study in part because her faith wasn't represented among the participants. Someone had to be the Muslim seat at the table, she told me. But as the only Muslim, she felt that participating meant stepping into a space not designed with you in mind. She had also read that psychedelics had shown promise in the treatment of trauma, which the Muslim community knows something about. Early in her first session, Ahmed told me that she felt God right behind her. Like if I turned around, I would bump into God, she said. There's a verse in the Quran which God says, I'm closer to you than your jugular vein. The jugular is the life-giving source. God was with me the whole time. For her, God was neither masculine nor feminine. God was above gender, above everything, an existence, not a figure, she said. And God was love. Her epiphany was a familiar psychedelic trope, but that did not make it any less profound. It was just mind-blowingly clear how wrong we have it as human beings and how we need to nurture love, to put it at the center of our engagement with humanity and animals and the planet, she told me. Ahmed said that during her second session, it dawned on me that the womb is the center of everything. The memory still makes her heart beat faster, she said. How incredibly glorious that women should have this exclusively and not anybody else. So why don't we have a culture where we drop down at the feet of these women in awe and love and respect? When I asked whether some Muslims would regard these ideas as heretical, she laughed. Not in her reading of Islamic scripture, which often accords women great respect. But yes, she said, in some Muslim cultures they might. In Islam, we prostrate to God and no one else, she said. For years after her psilocybin sessions, Ahmed felt unmoored, as though she were struggling to regain her sense of equipoise and purpose. In her community, those who know about psychedelics tended to lump them in with other illicit drugs. She felt that she could not talk with anybody, not even her family, about her experience, even though it was one of the most important in her life. She also felt that the team at Hopkins hadn't done enough to help her make sense of the experience. She called the sessions extractive. They were extracting data for the study and wished she'd had a chance to process them with people who looked like her. She found herself drifting away from prayers and rituals, and what little tolerance she had for misogyny and patriarchy was gone. Yet, as her relationship with God became less formal, it became more direct. I feel a closeness to God, even to this day, and I've never experienced before, she told me. She said that after the sessions, I would be in conversation with God when I was going down the stairs or getting on the bus or going into a meeting. We would chit-chat. It's a two-way conversation. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Many of the religious leaders experienced a change that was both personal and professional. Several reported that attendance at services was up. An Eastern Orthodox priest, who requested a pseudonym so he could speak freely, told me a particularly dramatic story of recommitting to his church. Father Gregory, as I'll call him, is a burly man with a salt and pepper beard who looks more like a big city cop than like a stereotypical clergyman. He told me that when he was a teenager, his father, on his deathbed, sought the comfort of a priest and had a conversion moment. After witnessing that, Gregory made the decision to join the priesthood and took a vow of celibacy. Over time, however, he grew frustrated with the church. I was not only burned out, but wanted to burn other people, he told me. I struggled with church politics and bureaucracy. I was a bitter person, someone other people would avoid. I had gotten stuck in the cycle of anger, frustration, pornography, isolation, and was kind of spinning out of control. He knew nothing about psychedelics or psychedelic-assisted therapy until he heard about the study. Gregory said that his first psilocybin session at NYU was the beginning of my softening, what I think of as the decallousing of my heart. During the session, he felt that he was laid out on a stone slab in the tomb of Christ, covered in rose petals. I realized I was dying, but it wasn't sad and I wasn't afraid, he told me. My body had died, but love was still in it, and love would survive my death. This was God's love, he understood, and it also felt unexpectedly sensual, which for a celibate priest was very dangerous territory. At first, he tried to hold back. He kept getting up and removing his eye mask and headphones to quell the intensity of the experience. But eventually he let go. It was ecstatic, he said. I was making love to love. It was disarming to hear a priest I'd only just met say such things without a whisper of irony, doubt, or embarrassment. He told me that at one point, rather than interrupt the powerful feelings washing over him with the trip to the bathroom, he released his bladder. A mentor in the church hierarchy quickly perceived that Gregory had changed and asked what had happened. I don't think I really believed what I had been doing, Gregory told me. I hated the liturgy, dreaded it. It was mechanical, something I put on a mass to do. But now it's a lot more meaningful and satisfying. I asked him how he understood the fact that this change was occasioned by a little blue capsule. It came through a pill, but the pill was touched, blessed by God, he said. People can be salvaged. His remarks echoed something that Roger Jocelyn, a study participant who serves two Episcopal congregations on Long Island, told me. I'm more awake, Jocelyn said. I just am. The experience made me a better person and a better priest. Jocelyn is in his 70s, but he has shelved plans to retire. He argued that pastors have a role to play in helping parishioners make sense of psychedelic experiences, even while psychedelics are illegal. I don't want to leave them to corporate America or to the therapist, he told me. Why should we be left out of these spiritual experiences? I thought we were in that business. No one has taken this idea further than Hunt Priest. In November 2020, after becoming the pastor at an Episcopal church in Georgia, he went on a retreat in the Texas desert with some friends. I spent a day trying to figure out what my role in life was going to be, he told me. In his view, he was part of an institution that was failing to satisfy its members' spiritual needs. Driving to church, I passed the yoga studio where people are lined up on Sunday morning, he told me. No such crowd was clamoring to get into church services. He called yoga an embodied spiritual practice and pointed to his forehead. We're all stuck up here, he said. Priest decided to leave his job and start an organization called Ligare, which in Latin means to tie or to bind. Swift, the study funder, had interviewed Priest. His family foundation eventually contributed $25,000. On its website, Legari describes itself as a Christian psychedelic society that believes psychedelics may be used sacramentally as a way of experiencing God's grace. Over time, many faiths pivot from a focus on direct spiritual experience, such as encounters with God or moments of transcendence, to a focus on traditional and belief. We're dealing with a kind of desert of experience in American religious life, Charles Stang, a professor of early Christian thought at Harvard Divinity School, told me. That's not normal in the history of religion. He finds psychedelics interesting because of their focus on experience, but he emphasized that spiritual experiences can be much more challenging than the ones that researchers were advertising. Less like Priest's sensation of the divine moving through him and more like Powell's encounter with nothingness. It can involve a God that actually spurns you, or like an encounter with God's unknowability, or with the annihilating non-existence of the abyss, Stang said. That's a very different kind of mystical experience than the warm, loving embrace, which seems to be what this study is pushing. Errol Goldberg, a rabbi and a psychotherapist in Maryland, told me that lasting religious experience comes from years of striving for understanding and wrestling with God. He added, "This is not to say that psychedelics can't play a role in that process, but it's a limited role." His remarks made me think of Houston Smith, the scholar and Good Friday Experiment participant, who once observed that a spiritual experience is different from a spiritual life. "We Americans are always looking for a shortcut," Goldberg said. Priest contends that psychedelics can be more easily folded into established faiths than shaped into a religion of their own. "I already have a church, and I think we have something to offer," he said. In the spring of 2022, Legari told 13 Christian ministers and 5 trained facilitators to the Netherlands, where some forms of psilocybin are legal. "Institution religion has a lot to learn from psychedelics," Priest told Don Latin, a reporter who has written extensively about religion and psychedelics, "and the psychedelic community has a lot to learn from organized religion." He told me that the gathering, which lasted 5 days, was a very normal Christian retreat, except there was this big experience with psilocybin truffles halfway through it. Priest and I had our conversation over lunch in 2023 in Denver, where we were both speakers at a conference called Psychedelic Science. More than 10,000 psychedelic researchers, entrepreneurs, therapists, and so-called psychonauts were there. So was Sugra Ahmad. Also in Denver were Jamie Clark Souls, the Baptist scholar. She is now writing a book called Psychedelics and Soul Care, What Christians Need to Know. And Zach Kamenetz, the rabbi from Berkeley. All were on panels about psychedelics and religion. This year, Ahmad quit her job to focus on an organization she founded, Rouhani, which plans to host psychedelic retreats and create a specifically Muslim container for psychedelic experiences. Kamenetz, who had worked at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, launched a group called Shifa, which will serve Jews who are interested in psychedelics, including Hasids on Friday night services tripping on mushrooms, Kamenetz said. By placing their experiences in a Jewish framework, Shifa 2 is funded in part by T. Cody Swift. Political safety required Jews, by and large, to give up their more mystical and ecstatic practices, both at home and in the synagogue, in order to look more like their Protestant neighbors, Kamenetz said. He argued that psychedelics could help bring back Jewish mysticism. Such perspectives clearly resonated at the conference. After one panel, a woman stepped up to the microphone and said, "I would go back to the church if I knew my priest had done this." Nearly a decade has passed since the first religious leaders were given psilocybin. One reason for the delay in publication is that two people, one linked to Legari and one affiliated with the study, made accusations of ethical lapses surrounding the research. Reverend Joe Welker, a Presbyterian pastor in Vermont, who was once an intern at Legari, published a critique of the study on Substack, writing that it was part of a strategy to integrate psychedelics into mainstream religion, and reached out to the Johns Hopkins Institutional Review Board, which is charged with protecting participants in human trials. 15 of the participants signed an open letter disagreeing with Welker. Johnson, the Hopkins researcher who co-authored the paper, had concerns that Roland Griffiths wanted psychedelic research to influence religious groups and contacted the IRB. After an audit and a review that lasted more than a year, the IRB told the study's authors that it had identified several instances of serious noncompliance with its policies and procedures, including conflicts of interest. It found in part that the researchers had failed to accurately report their funding sources and did not secure IRB approval for two members of the research team, one of whom was a funder, presumably Turnbull. In addition, it failed to report that a registered researcher, presumably Swift, was also a funder. The IRB reported its findings to the FDA and said that the study team would need to disclose them. All research performed across Johns Hopkins is expected to meet the highest standards for integrity, the IRB said in a statement to the New Yorker. When concerns were raised about this study, which was not federally funded, we immediately responded and conducted a comprehensive investigation. Stephen Ross at NYU acknowledged that these entanglements were inappropriate. A donor shouldn't be conducting research. It looks like paying to play, he told me. The fact that Swift gave money to Legarry and Shifa fits into conspiracy theories that we're all colluding to create a psychedelic religion. Ross described himself as a Jewish atheist. I was not aware that my dual role wasn't reported to the IRB, Swift told me. We had always planned to disclose it on paper. Alta Charo, a bioethicist who served on the IRB of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and who is not affiliated with the study, told me that a funder who participates in the research process introduces the potential for bias, conscious or unconscious, that goes beyond the biases that all researchers have. When I first asked Griffiths about the participants I might interview, he did not mention Zach Kamenetz or Hunt Priest. Later, I asked why and was told that they were outliers. Perhaps the researchers didn't want to stoke the narrative that some study participants have become advocates, even evangelists, for religious uses of psychedelics. Yet the only sense in which Priest and Kamenetz are outliers is that they left jobs in religious institutions to establish formal psychedelic organizations. It is fascinating that such a high percentage of them have decided to make psychedelics a real interest beyond the study, Swift told me. The researchers seemed divided on whether this was a good thing. All stressed that it was never their intention to inject psychedelics into organized religion. Yet some, such as Swift and Richards, have been openly supportive of that effort. Richards has spoken out at public Legarry events. Other co-authors seem more anxious about the aftermath. I've been worried from the beginning, Ross told me. Could this be something that really angers organized religion? Griffiths died in October 2023, but when we spoke at his home in suburban Baltimore a few months before that, he expressed concern about the implication that we should be introducing psychedelics into religion. He told me that psychedelics have great potential, but he worried that if they spread too rapidly, they could have unforeseen and potentially disastrous consequences, including the kind of backlash that brought psychedelic research to a halt in the 60s. We need to be cautious, he said, and later added, you don't want to mess too quickly with the institutional structures that support the entire culture. Here he sounded considerably more careful than he had a few years earlier when he routinely spoke of psychedelics as important for the survival of the species. When I asked Kamenetz if he could imagine a backlash, he joked, experiment inspires weird drug clergy. There's your headline. I reached out to Elaine Pagels, a historian and professor of religion at Princeton, for a reality check. In her 2018 memoir, Why Religion, Pagels wrote about taking LSD with her husband, the late physicist Heinz Pagels, in 1969 when she was in her 20s. The experience was astonishing and ecstatic, she told me in an email. After several hours, when I was too absorbed to speak, I said, I guess that solves the death problem. We both laughed. In subsequent decades, Pagels didn't closely follow developments in psychedelic research, but her interest was rekindled when Anthony Bosis reached out to her with questions about psychedelics in antiquity. Psychedelic medicine later invited her to write a commentary about the religious leader's study. I think the use of these chemicals under appropriate conditions can be enormously beneficial, she told me. At the same time, they can be nearly catastrophic for some. Pagels has written extensively about the early years of Christianity, when religious leaders suppressed followers who were more mystical. In certain ways, clergy who embraced psychedelic rituals resemble the second and third century Christians that Pagels has written about, many of whom believed that revelation was potentially available to everyone, that God had a feminine dimension, and that it's possible for individuals to experience God directly. Organized religion often opposes such figures. Religions can't survive if they're wide open to the claims of every individual with supposed experience of the divine. You can't have people going around saying, God told me to do this or that, Pagels told me, because you can really go off the rails. Even so, she was heartened by the depth and passion exhibited by many of the religious leaders in the study. Traditions can become fossilized, she said. Religious institutions will need to be enlivened and reimagined and transformed if they are to survive and serve people today. It's like art, she added. We don't just stay with the art of the 15th century. People are still making paintings. By Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan teaches creative writing at Harvard. His books include How to Change Your Mind and This Is Your Mind on Plants. Annals of Communication is Jeff Bezos selling out the Washington Post. How the paper that brought down Richard Nixon is struggling to survive the second term of Donald Trump. By Claire Malone. On a cold evening in March, a month and a half into the second Trump administration, a cold gathered in the Terrace Theater at the John F. Kennedy for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. Warren Buffett, the billionaire CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, was hosting a screening party for Becoming Katharine Graham, a new documentary selling the career of Washington Post's legendary publisher. Guests included Bill Gates, Bill Murray, the former Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, the Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar, and Bob Woodward, who along with Carl Bernstein broke the stories of Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal that came to define the paper's golden age. I had passed the Watergate Hotel on my way to the party. It sits alongside the Kennedy Center on the bank of the Potomac River. The pair of buildings, each a cream-colored behemoth, were complimented in the early 1970s, a fabled era in the Capitol when presidents feared journalists and the bipartisan elite dined together on lobster bisque and gossip. Katharine Graham, very quiet, wry, and patrician, was then one of the most powerful women in America. She not only ran the Post's business operations, following in the footsteps of her father, Eugene Mayer, and her husband, Phil Graham, but convened members of the Washington establishment around her dinner table in Georgetown, the tiny kingdom, as Phil Graham once called it. A few weeks earlier, Donald Trump had launched a hostile takeover of the Kennedy Center, naming himself as its chair and ending a spirit of bipartisanship that had long reigned in one of D.C.'s most cherished cultural institutions. The center canceled a performance by the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington, D.C., and expressed an eagerness to book Cats. Now, as the lights dim, Graham's son, Don, dressed in a sports coat and New Balance sneakers, stepped up to the lectern. His mother, he said, had to stand up to one president who had carried 49 states and who truly, as you are about to see, wanted to use the government to destroy her newspaper and her company. Nixon's attorney general once told Bernstein that Katie Graham's gonna get her tit caught and a big fat ringer, but Don Graham was likely also alluding to more recent events. He had succeeded his mother as the Post publisher, overseeing the paper's business side for 3 decades before it was sold in 2013 to the founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos. 3 years later, just before the 2016 presidential election, Bezos said that Trump's calls for retribution and his unwillingness to concede defeat erodes our democracy around the edges. But in the weeks before the 2024 election, Bezos didn't allow the Post to endorse a presidential candidate. The editors had planned to back Kamala Harris, breaking with the paper's long-standing tradition. After the election, he attended Trump's inauguration, to which his company donated $1 million. Days before the Kennedy Center screening, Bezos announced another major shift at the paper. The opinion section would feature pieces in support and defense of 2 pillars, personal liberties and free markets, and viewpoints opposing those pillars will be left to be published by others. In the days of Woodward and Bernstein, the Post's remit had seemed clear: to hold the nation's most powerful officials to account. Now its journalists were shaken, not just by what some saw as Bezos' capitulation to Trump, but by a broader identity crisis at the paper. Those who could find work elsewhere left. In January, a former executive director, Leonard Downey Jr., and a former managing editor, Robert Kaiser, wrote in an email to Bezos, "In our experience going back to the early 1960s, morale at the Post has never been lower." Bezos never replied. After the film, guests drifted to a reception in a large gallery where Woodward soon confronted Bill Murray. Murray had recently said on Joe Rogan's podcast that he was so dismayed after reading like 5 pages of Wired, Woodward's 1984 book about Murray's old friend John Belushi, that he thought, "Oh my God, they framed Nixon." At the reception, Woodward interrupted a conversation Murray was having with Klobuchar to defend his work. "Sometimes we learn by talking," Woodward said. Murray turned away. Buffett's publicist quickly intervened. Afterward, more than one attendee described the reception, which featured hot hors d'oeuvres appetizers, white orchids, and a room full of septuagenarians, as a wake for the Graham family's Post. The paper's current leadership was noticeably absent. Will Lewis, a former executive at Rupert Murdoch's Dow Jones, whom Bezos had appointed as the paper's publisher in early 2024, had RSVP'd that he would attend and then asked to see the guest list. Lewis denies asking to see the guest list. He and the Post's editor, Matt Murray, a recent arrival from the Wall Street Journal, had ultimately stayed away. Bezos was out of town, preferring instead to attend the Academy Awards with his fiancée, the journalist Lauren Sanchez. Bezos was always seen as a somewhat distant owner. Amazon's holdings now include Whole Foods, Zappos, the streaming site Twitch, and MGM Studios. Blue Origin, Bezos's aerospace company, is a direct competitor of Elon Musk's SpaceX in the race to privatize space travel. He was sort of like a helicopter parent, a former longtime employee at one of Bezos's business told me, giving a lot of direction on a Wednesday and then leaving us to pick up the pieces. Still, no one seemed to know what his current vision for the Post might be. In some ways, this is all a story about Jeff and how he changed over the course of his ownership and really became a different person with huge implications for the institution, one former top editor told me. A journalist who knows Bezos said, "He's on an intellectual journey. Wherever he lands, he's thinking, whatever it is, it's a mind at work." At the end of 2012, Don Graham and his niece Catherine Weymouth, then the Post publisher, met at the Bombay Club, a restaurant near the White House that was especially popular during the Clinton era, to discuss the paper's finances. The Post was entering its 7th year of declining revenue, and for the first time they were considering the possibility of selling. "We asked ourselves if we thought our small public company was still the best place for the newspaper," Graham said at the time. The Post had been in the family since 1933, when Eugene Meyer, a former chairman of the Federal Reserve, bought it at auction. The Grahams, like the Sulzberg family, which had owned the New York Times for more than a century, viewed the paper not just as a business, but as a civic trust. Don and his mother were fixtures in the Post headquarters on 15th Street. Don seemed to know everyone's name, reporters, receptionists, custodians. For years, the Post was a thriving regional monopoly, servicing one of the country's wealthiest and most educated metropolitan areas. The emergence of the internet threatened all that. In August 1992, Kaiser, the managing editor, returned from a conference in Japan and wrote a memo to the paper's leadership about the coming upheaval. "The Post is not in a pot of water, and we're smarter than the average frog," he said. "But we do find ourselves swimming in an electronic sea where we could eventually be devoured or ignored as an unnecessary anachronism." Within a decade, Craigslist had decimated the industry's classified ads revenue. In 2003, another Post managing editor, Steve Cole, proposed a plan to reconfigure the newsroom to adapt to the internet and use the paper's name recognition to become more national in scope. Don Graham rejected the idea, saying that he wanted to maintain the paper's local identity. His strategy eventually became "For and About Washington." And that's all we have time for today. Claire Malone is a staff writer at The New Yorker, covering the media business, journalism, and politics. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.